We're back for part two of Don't Pass Me By with Joseph Brutsman and Tony Peck. It's a fascinating conversation. Again, the book is called My Life and Filmmaking Adventures with Hollywood's Polar Opposites, the title Marlon and Greg from 2021 and Bear Manor Media, where Ben Omar is running things. So we're back here for part two. So enjoy the listen.
Tony, well, are you
happy
there?
To be here? Yeah, I'm here, Joe.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Bob.
So, Joey,
I
wanted to introduce a favorite subject of ours, Joey, and ask you, you and I have talked about what makes a legacy. And we even wrote a screenplay in which that was a central theme.
Right.
And I'm reminded that this is a circular way of getting back to it, but I'm reminded of conversations we've had about the subject, about what makes a legacy and what is a legacy. And I remember an evening when you and I were at Juilliard, and they would give us tickets to see Broadway and off-Broadway shows all the time. I mean, it seemed like once a week you could go to a show. Juilliard had 10 tickets, 20 tickets. So we didn't always go to the same shows, but frequently we did. And I remember going to a show with Kelly McGillis, and there were several other Juilliard students there. I can't remember if you were one, and I also don't remember the show, but this is what I remember. After the show, as we were exiting this Broadway theater, Jack Nicholson exited that Broadway theater. He had just seen the same show, and he was, I mean, in a way, in the 80s and 90s, he was like Frank. I mean, he was the coolest guy in the room. He was the guy everybody wanted to be with, to know. And I was standing on the curb with Kelly watching Jack Nicholson exit. He had on those dark glasses. He gets into a limo, and as he does, he gets a look at Kelly, who was a beautiful young actor at the time, actress. And he continues getting in, and then in this limo, and then he turns around and leers at us out of the back window of, I think it was a town car, actually. And he just grinned at us as though he understood everything that had transpired. He understood us looking at him. He knew that we understood him looking at Kelly. The whole, and then he peeled into that Cheshire Cat grin. He just grinned as his car pulled away. And it was kind of a profound moment for me. There was no words exchanged. He had no idea who we were. He knew exactly that we, he knew that we knew exactly who he was. It was a complete moment. But that leads me back to the legacy question. We've discussed so many actors in this regard. But in the final analysis, where do you think Marlon falls today?
Marlon Brando today?
2022. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we have had this discussion. We even talked about Jack, too, because it's so fascinating that Nicholson was so much of our youth and so huge. And I know you knew him, you know him, and I'm curious if we'll ever see Jack. I don't, that's the thing about someone who's a legend like that. You don't know what their private life is and where they are. But I'm curious as to where, you know, years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, where Jack Nicholson, how we'll look at it, where the films are, what was that about? He's fascinating to me. With Marlon, it's a great question. People have been asking me all week, have I seen The Offer? I haven't seen The Offer. Have you been watching The Offer, Tony?
No, I haven't seen it either, but I've, like you, I've been hearing about it all over the place.
Yeah, maybe they're, I mean, I guess you can stream it anytime on Paramount Plus, and so I don't know, but somehow it's a number of people are all getting right to the Brando chapter right now. Have you seen this in The Offer? I'll have to take a look. Marlon,
I mean,
and his
I especially
legacy,
want to take a look. I especially want to take a look because we knew those guys. All of them.
What's interesting, I want to talk to you about that because Tony and I both worked with and knew Al Ruddy quite well, and he was a remarkable man. I mean, not many guys stand there with two Best Picture Oscars in their hands, and people still don't always know what they did and who they were. Al Ruddy is an incredible guy, and the offer, I guess Paramount's look at The Godfather is really about Al. And Al, yeah, to me, I just thought he was the sweetest guy. We wrote a screenplay for Al. He wanted to do kind of a remake of it wasn't Kelly's Heroes, was it? He loved military humor. He created Hogan's Heroes for Bing Crosby, yes, of all people. And Al was and is just the most likable guy. And everybody from, obviously, you know, Robert Evans to Clint Eastwood saw that, knew that. And anyway, so I want to see The Offer because I hear it's good. Marlon, I guess, I don't know how he's portrayed in there. But he was in the news again with that. I guess sometimes it depends on what the news is, if it's still the news. Aubrey was talking to me about Sashine Littlefeather, who was in the news. And I bring it up because you're talking about, you know, when do people remember these people? And yes, I think to myself, you know, I was reading Aubrey's good friends with Sashine, and I think, you know, they're glad that the Academy has seen that it was kind of a very difficult night for her. Here we are addressing it, what, 50 years later or something like that?
Wow, yeah.
And I wanted to bring that up, Tone, and I want to get into that question, too, because there's no real answers, but for, I think, just a great conversation to have about how these,
yeah,
how do these things survive. But back to Sashine. Abra was really, you know, again, likes her very much, and it's interesting. She still has and I guess understandably, a connection with the Brando estate. But I started to wonder when I was reading this article about that, and Greg was very much an Academy man at that time, and I thought, I wondered if, I never pretended that Greg and Marlon had this great friendship, but I got these three photos to go by. Remember, I've shown you these all the way from the 50s to the one in your dad's office to that strange one,
yes,
in the 60s with Pat Boone. And I thought, I wonder if that night in 72 or 73, whatever the ceremony was that just a real last straw for Greg? I mean, because Gregory was so... you know what I'm saying, Greg? It's not that he was...
I do.
He didn't have a false reverence for the Academy. He just knew that there's a respectful thing to be had for a business that was very good to you. And when I think of Marlon doing this, especially a year after George C. Scott had already kind of done it better, if you will, I'll make that editorial. I think when George C. Scott said no, it was just, I don't compete with my fellow actors. He showed up to do it. I think just like everything Marlon did, there was kind of a interesting hodgepodge of thought about it. And here he was getting this incredibly huge comeback opportunity. Not that that meant a lot to Marlon, but I think it did. That was always the thing with Brando. What really meant something to him, what didn't, you don't know. But I think when I watched the reception, I was watching that tape because of the Sashine Littlefeather. I guess the event this last week was... The Academy apologized to her for the way she was treated that night or something to that effect. And it took me back to an era when Greg was, you know, he was certainly must have been on the board of the Academy. I don't know what year he was president, or I can't recall at the moment. And he even produced one of the ceremonies. But I just think there were a lot of people, and there was Roger Moore standing there with he was the one I think was supposed to give the award out, with I don't remember who he was with, but someone will know that. And he stood there as she said, Marlon Brando can't accept this award. Long story short, you were what, about 14, 15 in that era?
56, 66, maybe, yeah, 14 sounds right.
Yeah, I mean, you might have been lost in karate at the time, but the question I had, did Greg ever mention that this was not something an actor should do? I wondered, because a lot of people had real bad feelings about Marlon doing that.
Sure, and I read all about that, And I never spoke to my dad about that moment. I wish I had, but I'm quite sure that it would not have been his first choice. And I mean, you can't help but think of the slap in a similar regard. Anything that, you know, the recent slap, anything that takes away from those recipients and nominees is undesirable. But I think it's fascinating that the Academy did recently make some statement of contrition to Sasheen. That's fascinating to me. Is it to you?
Yeah, I know there might have been a movement. I should ask Avra more about it, because Avra just a few months ago was at a ceremony and some evening for Sasheen, and she's an interesting figure. She's still around, and she is certainly a well-respected member within her tribe still, and so it's really, you know, she's a fascinating individual, and there might even be a documentary about her, and maybe that led to certain things, as we all know that can do. You know, you awareness is created, and then people feel they should respond. And we're certainly in an era where people feel they want to, they might have to, we might want to speak to past injustices, whatever.
Well, that's where I was headed, Joe. My question to you, and I don't know the answer. Do you think if the Academy made some statement referring to that evening in 1972 or 3, when she made her statement, instead of Marlon going up and accepting the award, if there was recently some statement of contrition, is that the influence of woke culture? That's my question.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that, you know, for better or worse, I think someone is thinking that we should, address these things and redress these things, because they took place. Look, you know, it's funny. John Wayne, obviously, I think he spoke up after that happened, and I think everyone probably knew what John Wayne might have had to say about that. And we look at John Wayne today, and they dig up old quotes of John Wayne, understandably, and some people say, well, why do we still have an airport named after him if he said this and that? So, yeah, that happens a lot today, sure. But I also think that it's funny, you so perfectly nailed it when you brought up the slap, because I think that was the slap of its day, exactly. I mean, that it's funny, I never even put it in that words or those
but
thoughts.
You know,
but you're right.
But you know who else? There was another moment similar to that when the couple Tim and Susan Sarandon made a political statement just before they read the nominees and handed the Oscar. Do you remember this?
What do you remember the years of this?
No, I don't. But it would have. My guess is that it was in the late 80s or very early 90s. And
well, I think there were a lot of these, right? There were a lot of these. That I mean, I distinctly remember 76, and Vanessa Redgrave went up, and she spoke about Palestinians. And then Paddy Chayefsky went up for Network right after her, and then he just said, this is not the place to do that. And so I guess it's always, look, you get this worldwide platform, if you will. I mean, I just kind of I find it entertaining in some way to see the old footage of Marlon accepting his On the Waterfront Oscar and then doing an interview right afterwards with Edward R. Murrow and his own father of how proud he was and how badly he wanted it way back, and not way back, but 2 years before Waterfront when he was up for Streetcar. And then to have that much time go by, that's where I just think the changes in Gregory, and I'm sorry, the changes in Marlon and the changes in the industry and what his life was between, say, Waterfront and Godfather, he was a different man.
He was a different man,
and, yeah. And yes, the world had changed, the industry had changed, but that's where I look at his fame and think what a strange burden it was on him, because he just, you know, God bless him, he always just thought he could reinvent everything. And that's where I think, you know, so much of his lifestyle was just so erratic, if you will, you know.
But I mean, the burden that he carried of being labeled the world's greatest actor, that's almost an impossible thing to live up to, and yet he did. But imagine the pressure, the professional pressure, every time you go out to do a picture, you're supposed to better your last performance.
Well, and you're supposed to change things. You know, The Godfather was a sad kind of almost dangerous thing, because it told him no matter what the past record was, he could pull a rabbit out of a hat. And it's not his, I'm not saying he didn't do it himself, but clearly it took a lot of people and a lot of situations, and all, just the stars had to align just right and correctly to create a Godfather. I mean, Francis Coppola knew that himself. And that's the strangest thing, you know. So I think when Marlon became Brando all over again in a certain way in 72, and I've always said, and I did talk to him about this, you know, he said, I talked to him a number of times, Last Tango always fascinated me, because I've always said it was kind of the most dangerous film he ever did. He always wanted a film where he could just kind of improvise, do what he felt was right, and he finally got it. He really kind of finally got it. You can see notes of it in other films like Ugly American and Appaloosa and these other films, but you really see it completely in Last Tango. You see a man improvising, telling his own life story. He talks about his childhood, and he's talking about a guy in Nebraska. He's telling his own story. And then when all the misery and sorrow in that film comes along, he lives that too. Mm-hmm. And He finally got to do a film where he didn't have to show up or read a cue card or anything. He just got to, you know, I think he saw reality TV before it ever existed. And yet, in a film that dark and that tragic, he put himself through the ringer. And I think, I remember he said he was never going to work that hard again. You know, and that's where I, as I talk about in the book, he loved the fact that our script was a comedy. And he just wanted to play like a big, funny, dangerous thing. It wasn't quite the character I think we created. But, you know, he wanted to have a good time doing that film. And I'm so glad he did, because it was one of the last things he really did. And he enjoyed doing it.
You know, I was so impressed and surprised and shocked one day when... I don't think I was on the set that day, but you came back from the set and you told me that Marlon had sort of reconceived the scene and he was now going to use a cow prod. Now, that was not in our screenplay, but Marlon had totally understood the point of that scene, naturally. How could he not? And he had decided to dramatize it in a way that was so hilarious and so, I mean, unexpected. You said the word cow prod, and it was though I had been jolted by a cow prod. To think that he had come with this idea, brought it to the set, and that was now going to be the scene. Will you tell me a little bit about that, Joey? That day?
Yeah. He was always reinventing the scenes in a certain way, and just sometimes small ways and sometimes large ways. And he was supposed to he already had a sit down with the guys before they married his daughters. This is the film Free Money. And he played this warden whose daughters married these slacker guys played by Charlie Sheen and Thomas Hayden Church. And Tony and I wrote the film, for those who might not know it, and check it out. It's online somewhere, I'm sure. But the funniest thing is Marlon, his character, we called him the Swede, he didn't like these men as his sons-in-laws, or however you phrase it.
So, and he was the local prison warden.
he was a local prison warden, so there's a lot of complications that ensue throughout this story. But when the guys are such, they mess up their lives so badly, they end up living with him and being supported by him. He kind of just gets to do whatever he wants to make their lives miserable. And one day he just decides that it hit him. He wanted to make this guy a real Bible scholar. And if these guys ever use the Lord's name in vain, he would get to use a cattle prod on them. And one day he just tells them, Marlon comes and says, he's telling me the scene. He says, you know, these guys, there's swearing in this script. I said, yeah. He said, so Charlie and Tom are, I've heard these four-letter words. I said, yeah. He said, the Swede doesn't like that. I said, probably not. He said, yeah. So I didn't even think about it. And I go on set, and they've set up this whole thing where, because they've used these four-letter words, he's going to use a cattle prod on them. And he's reading the Bible to them. He just created this scene. And I'm, you know, really grateful that the company said, let's try it. Marlon wants to try it. Let's try it. And we had some broad stuff in the script, but nothing that broad. And Marlon decided he's going to use a cattle prod on these guys. And I had to go look it up, and I found out this would kill a person. But that was here nor there. And anyway, that was just the kind of stuff he brought to scripts. You know, he wanted to invent certain ways what he was doing. You know, someone asked me the other day, they had read the book, and they said, well, I'm a little confused when this section where you rewrote the script with him for weeks or months, and then he was just fine that you didn't do it. I don't understand that kind of thinking. And I should have been more clear in the book, perhaps, because I wanted to make it clear. Marlon, he dabbled like that. He'd be rewriting the script just like you just pointed out something quite perfect in what I was thinking, Tone. You know, he would be writing the script the moment you're doing it, the second you're doing it. He won't give you the line, he'll give you a different line.
You know,
and that chapter, go ahead.
Well, in that case, as in so many cases, Bob, I'm sure all of them, when Marlon brought inventions that were not in the script, whether they were lines or scenes or props, whatever it was, he made it better. He was in tune with himself. He understood the situations, the scene, the pages, the script, the characters, and he would enhance. He would bring it. He would make it better. And I remember as a young writer thinking, you know, these words are gold. These cannot be changed. This might as well be carved in stone. Yes, you don't change this. And then I learned over time that on the set things do change, and they should change. But I think in many ways they also should not change in the following way. Actors who know what they're doing, who have earned their place, sure, if they've got a better idea, go for it. I'm 100% behind you. Young actors, they haven't proven themselves. Why would they change the script? Because they were written by writers, and that's what the writer, they write. And then the actors are, in my mind, the actors take those words and then they breathe life into those words. They don't change them. But when you reach the level of people like Marlon and Greg, although I don't think my dad changed very many lines, but I remember, here's a good story. Let me tell this quickly. I knew Bob Rafelson, the director. He made a movie that I loved called Blood and Wine. And It starred Jack Nicholson. It had been directed by Bob Rafelson. They'd been friends for decades. And I loved the movie. It was a B movie with A-list talent. It was a film noir. And there was one line in there that was so hilarious to me. And I ran into Rafelson 10 years after I'd seen the movie. I said, Bob, I didn't realize that in addition to, because I'd seen the movie recently and I realized he'd also written the screenplay in addition to directing, I said, Bob, I didn't realize you had written the screenplay. I mean, there are incredible lines in there. And he said, well, what's
your favorite line? Is there a four-letter word here, Tom? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No,
is there a four-letter word here?
No, there is a four-letter. I'm not going to say it. So I told him my favorite line. Joey, I'm with you. I'm with you. I told him my favorite line, and Bob kind of said, oh, that was one of Jack's improvisations. So he hadn't even written what was my favorite line, which I thought was hilarious.
No, that happens all the time. I mean, we had guys even improvising small parts on Free Money, and I see them quoted. But the line from that film, yeah, is so hilarious, and it's so Jack Nicholson. I mean,
let me ask this question: there were other actors improvising on Free Money, younger actors.
Yeah.
Did they, like Marlon and Hanson, make it better, or should they have stuck with the original words?
Yeah, you know, well, there's an example. You know, we wrote this, the film has this long train robbery, and these poor morons, played by Charlie and Tom, have to, they think if they block the tracks with a truck that belongs to Marlon, that the train will stop and then they can rob it. And sadly for them, the train just goes right through the truck, and that was. And Tony and I wrote that, and they went and shot it. You know, it was a very expensive day and shoot. But one of these young actors playing the engineers, he said something like, "He said, did we hit a cow?" And he says, "Cows don't blow up." And I don't know if we wrote it. I don't know if we wrote it that way. And I thought that was a very good line. That was pretty good.
Yeah, that is a good line. I bet we wrote it.
yeah, we might have. But I mean, yeah, so that's the hazard of someone like Marlon sometimes, because other actors feel now they can say something and do something. And with Marlon, you sometimes have to. But, you know, it's funny. You touched on something about Greg. When we were writing with Greg, and that's where I had really the impetus about the book, when here we were writing Free Money, and it was around the same time we're writing Dr. DeMott, a script that we were writing for Gregory with Martin Scorsese from a script by Ingmar Bergman, rewriting it with Sean Penn. I mean, it was an amazing, heady time for me. But Greg knew what he wanted that script to be. And that's where you talk about, it gets back to what you were saying, Tone, I think that, you know, you shouldn't always endorse what an actor on the set wants to do. Greg really wanted that script perfect. He knew what he wanted as we were sitting there writing. And I learned so much listening to him because he had the most interesting little corrections. And I say corrections in that he just knew from these great screenwriters through the years of like it takes a turn here. You're going to want someone else to come in here. As the lead, he probably wouldn't say that. As you know, and they were just these little things that I thought, is that a rule? And I thought, no, it's not a rule, but it works. It works because they've been doing it this way for a long time. Now you have to find a different interpretation of why that would be different. But I'll tell you, I mean, he understood screenplays like nobody, and that's what I think was great. You know, how he respected the writers so much, you know.
I agree with you, Joe. And in the book, you detail that exact episode so beautifully, the way Greg was organizing the script and charging us with how to write it. Your description of that was so perfect. It really got to the essence of Greg's way of working.
Well, and it was so, I go back to the polar opposites. You know, how it was so frustrating at times with Marlon to realize that no matter what you had on paper, it just wasn't, that. And I think Marlon thought in some way, I go way back to what we were talking about earlier, Tony. When these men got to be at a place where they are above the title, and they are the entire reason the film is being made. I think Greg still understood he was part of something else. And I think Marlon, this is just what I saw. I think Marlon felt, why am I showing up to do this work or read someone else's script or take this direction if this is a Marlon Brando movie and I'm going to get blamed for it if it's bad or maybe praised if it's good? Really interesting. I mean, you can make a case for either mindset, mm-hmm. I suppose. But I always respected the fact that Greg was so, you know, he knew how this stuff worked. And, you know, when he would listen to, like, we'd have those phone calls with Scorsese, and you guys had meetings with Martin out in New York, I know. And, you know, he clearly respected a guy like Martin Scorsese, it seemed to me. And once Sean was our director for some time, he wanted to hear mm-hmm. what Sean was going to do. And, you know, Marlon, again, this is kind of free-for-all situation. And as I say in the book, that is the oddity of Hollywood. I mean, you can make it just like the Army would make it, or you could make a film that's basically maybe a free-for-all, and it might work. It's so funny you mentioned a guy like Rafelson, who I just think is amazing. He's to me, it's kind of a short list of films, but they're just all of that moment, of that early 70s. You know, I just think that's I love that time. And that was a really interesting time for Greg and Marlon, the early 70s. You know, I think, as I say in the book, before Godfather and Omen, I think there was this time where here's these actors, these different time it seemed, and you knew we weren't done with them because they were both just so big and so beloved by the public. But it's still a game of hit movies for some reason. And that crazy period with Rapelson and Nicholson and you know, Alice's Restaurant and Arthur Penn. Well, you were there. What did Greg make of all that at the time? Did he ever think that maybe just the lunatics were running the asylum, or what was his thought on that? Do you recall?
You know, I don't, and I also think that you could speculate what he thought, probably better than I could. I didn't talk to him too much about that. I was into my karate, and I just don't know. But also, you know, there was a big transition going on from what really was, in a sense, Greg's era and the height of his career in the late 40s, 50s, 60s. And then at that time, the anti-hero started becoming what everybody wanted to see. And that's what brought in
right.
people like Nicholson and Al Pacino and Gene Hackman. So I wonder what my dad was thinking of what was becoming in Hollywood, the country. What would he do? Can you imagine for me?
I think you know. Well, I still think it's I personally, as you know, the fact that he kept his liberal sensibilities and everything is just showed me the kind of good man for me he was. You know, he didn't take some turn, all due respect, like Charlton Heston or John Wayne, to be sure. And he, by the way, Greg was still making very interesting movies. If you look at like Walk the Line and some of those of that era, they were interesting films. Just very different for him. And I think that, you know, he understood art so well. He understood these eras. You know, I always love, he always said every generation wants their own heroes. He always said that. And so he understood, like, if suddenly a Dustin Hoffman is who a film is circled around, he'd understand it. I mean, I think he understood. He would look at The Graduate probably and say, yeah, this is, you know, the lights came on for some people. But also, I mean, at the same time, you know, there are a lot of actors who just got angry about that. You know, I remember even as a kid, Charlton Heston said, you know, I think John the Baptist is a more interesting person than Razzo Rizzo. And I thought, well, you know, that I expected that from Charlton Heston in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I think Charlton Heston was a wonderful actor. I just think that that really had to be a giant change. And I remember Marlon, I think so much of his anger with Charlie Chaplin was that right when the rating system changed and right when the lights came on and suddenly Hollywood went from like Hello Dolly to The Graduate, and Marlon Brando, who was like suddenly made for this, you'd think, right? You'd think the first thing Brando is going to do is do something, you know, that we're going to talk about. No, he went for like a year over to England because Charlie Chaplin made this offer for a film he wrote like in the 20s. And if you watch Countess from Hong Kong, it's really a sad affair because it's a Charlie Chaplin movie. And if you watch it, you see Marlon forced into a film that would have starred Chaplin quite well in 1929 or 1928. But instead, Marlon Brando is being forced to do this really bizarre film financed by Sophia Loren's husband. And I bring all those players into it because, you know, Marlon just felt trapped. Here he was, Hollywood's there making these films. And suddenly, we're not children anymore. We're doing this type of thing. And, you know, here was Brando. He's been in shackles ever since Waterfront, Streetcar. And he's over in England doing a film, being bossed around by this man, a man who says, Marlon, watch me. I'm going to do it one more time and do it exactly as I tell you. Do not do it any other way. Do it exactly as you see. And that's exactly the way Chaplin was, I guess. And by the way, Chaplin did that, you know, back in the days of Chaplin, of course. And think about it. Chaplin doing that in the 20s, you needed that because there was no roadmap. Charlie was the roadmap. He would tell people, do it like this, and we're going to do 100 takes of it until I feel it's perfect. Well, here was Chaplin doing this in 1967, and Marlon stuck over there. Anyway, I mention it because I think to myself, it was an interesting time period. You know, Marlon thought I had to do it. He passed on a lot of different pictures. And I think, you know, Greg, that I get back to here. How did someone like Gregory Peck still maintain who he was? He was still Gregory Peck. And he's still doing, he's doing certain films that still had a huge box office, like Marooned and some others of that era. And you know, until again, something as big as The Omen, which I still say changed all of A-list thrillers from that moment on for studios. And so again, I can't get over the fact that these two guys were so different and that Greg stayed a certain course and he knew there'd be something down here that would be good for him, that he could serve, that would serve him, and vice versa, something like The Omen and other pictures. And Marlon, because he was a fan, he goes overseas for Charlie Chaplin because he loved those old slapstick things. And he was angry about it the rest of his life.
He
would not stop. Yeah,
I never knew that, Joe. I never knew the genesis of how he came to do that movie. I'd never heard this before. It's fascinating to me. So there was Marlon poised to lead the pack of anti-heroes.
Yeah.
Right here at home.
When you think about it, yes. Right? Yeah, he wasn't the young man that Pacino and these guys were. He wasn't Warren Beatty at the time. But he was a guy who, now you could say four-letter words, now there could be nudity, there could be all kinds of things that would be, you know, right in his wheelhouse, if you will.
He was a guy who'd been nominated and won the award for playing anti-heroes. He was the anti-hero's anti-hero.
Yeah.
In so many films.
Yes, exactly.
And there he gets stuck doing this, as you put it so well, he gets stuck doing Hello, Dolly.
Well, yeah, and again, like I said, I had seen bits and pieces of Countess from Hong Kong, but when I was writing the book, I thought, I'm going to see if I can get through this whole thing for once. And someone put the whole film up on YouTube. And he plays this ambassador, and there's a woman hiding in his trunk, and it's Sophia Loren. And you can just picture Chaplin doing this, right? Or at the best, maybe in 1967, you could have Rex Harrison doing this, right? But Marlon Brando having to imitate Charlie Chaplin, I find it so fascinating. Right. But then I watch an interesting film. I was watching Walk the Line a few months ago, Tuesday Weld, and I thought, this is interesting. This interests me. That's where I said, I had that little mention in the book. I said, when Greg was doing different films in different genres, with whether they be Westerns or swashbucklers or contemporary military comedy, whatever, he brought something different every time. And with that, I want to talk to Bob Wilson because, Tony, you and I were talking earlier about when Greg gave a Kennedy Center Award to Bob Dylan. I don't know anybody who knows both, or at least has admiration in the way that he does for both Bob Dylan and Gregory Peck, the way Bob Wilson does. But we found out a lot more. I'll bet Bob might know more about this than we do. I don't know. Bob, are you?
Yes.
There?
Yes, sir.
We were looking into the whole Brownsville girl thing, and there's still a YouTube of Greg giving out the award. And if I could, real quick, Tony, you said you did talk to Greg when he was going to give that award out to Bob Dylan, right?
Yes, I did. But Bob, and I'll tell you about that in a moment, Bob, you were aware that that Dylan asked my dad to present him with the Kennedy Center Honors, yes?
Well, I had known he had given it to him, but you made the last time we were on, you made very clear that he requested him, so that was very interesting.
That's right. I thank you for reminding me. I wasn't sure if we discussed that or not, and I know I told you because that's the only thing that the recipient is allowed to do. Who do you want to present you with the award? And then everything the recipient gives the name, and everything else is done. So I watched that recently, and I love the way Greg, my dad, saw Dylan, because he really, I think, understood in a way as he saw Frank. He saw Dylan as an artist. He didn't know mm-hmm. Dylan very well at all, but he related to him. He related to Dylan as an artist. He knew that Dylan was a poet, was a chronicler, and even a troubadour. And I think he loved that about Dylan.
Well, it's funny. Also, you guys spoke a lot about Frank Sinatra, and that was so interesting. Bob Dylan went to Frank's 80th birthday, which was filmed for TV, and he was trying to sing one of Frank's songs. And it wasn't flying, you know, in rehearsals. And he picked another song of his own. It comes from the Irish song, The Parting Glass. And he sang that. And Frank Sinatra, you know, who's such a wonderful singer and phraser, and his voice is so different from Dylan's. It didn't just look like a show business personality who was trying to, you know, convey or act an emotion. It seemed like he was very taken by what Dylan was singing. And the song was perfect for Frank Sinatra. You know, to all the women I've loved, you know, I never wanted to act harmfully. You know, we stayed in the bar till the last glass was finished. But, you know, these guys themselves in their lives, your father, Bob Dylan, Frank Sinatra stood up for civil rights. And Dylan, his life was threatened in Dallas when he had a concert after Kennedy had been killed. And, you know, it's on film where they came in his dressing room and said there was a death threat and, you know, they threatened to shoot him and he still went on with the show. And he opened up for Martin Luther King before King gave the I Have a Dream speech. So really it was people then, the common bond between these gentlemen, I think, if I could, you know, be so bold as to conclude something, but they all put themselves at risk to speak up. And it wasn't only in a way that, you know, this is the latest charity. It seemed like that was something that was heartfelt, Marlon Brando as well, which you know better than I. But you know, I think that was a thread between them. And from that time, speaking out from music, speaking out from Hollywood, using the medium that you're, you know, big in or, you know, established in to speak up for that cause, I think was a bond between those men. And I think when they got to the Kennedy Center, you know, John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, you know, were movers and shakers in that as well. It was kind of like all that thread wove together, you know, and these two gentlemen were on the same stage. But for me, it went back to Bob Dylan being willing to stand, you know, come out and play at, you know, before all those people at the Washington Monument, and Gregory Peck marching, and Charlton Heston marched, and Frank Sinatra spoke up, you know, made sure, you know, his friendship with Sammy Davis, I think, was a statement as well. He was really his friend, but also they were speaking out for that cause. So I think that was a thread between the guys.
I have no doubt of it, Bob. I never knew that about Bob Dylan, that his life was threatened and that he opened up that afternoon when Martin Luther King gave the speech. I didn't know that, but that's very, very moving to me. I love that. And yeah, how could it be any other way but a thread that connected them? That takes a lot of courage to go on after you've been informed that there's a death threat against you. That's not nothing.
They said a rifle in the building, and Dylan said, don't tell me these things before I go on.
He said,
wow.
Well, repeat now, what he said, please, Bob.
I couldn't hear the last thing.
No, I didn't hear. So they told him there was a rifle in the room, and what did Dylan say?
Well, it was before a concert in Dallas, you know, and Kennedy had already been shot there. And Dylan had been, you know, singing these songs like Blowing in the Wind, you know, how many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man and such. And, you know, speaking out for civil rights, and which Gregory Peck, you know, in To Kill a Mockingbird, different form of art, but you could see as different as these men were.
Yes.
The thread was pulling together, but Dylan was in the dressing room with his band, and, you know, the gentleman around the theater came in and he said, you know, there's been a death threat, you know, with a rifle, just, I guess, to be square, so Dylan knew what he was up against. And Dylan said, oh, man, please don't, you know, don't tell me these things before the show. And then he made a joke of it. The drummer got scared, and he said, oh, Mickey, I'll protect you. You know, but he made a joke of it, but, you know, his life had been threatened, and he still went
out
and such. And he had opened up the King, which I think they have it on YouTube, which has so much on it, but you can watch that. And I just think Gregory Peck, you know, Atticus, what was that, Atticus Productions as well as company, he was so synonymous with that, and his character made the part so believable. It was such an important statement in American history. You know, the average person going to the movies is being, you know, sort of spoken to through this art form about equality. Yeah. And Dylan was doing the same thing in his art, so it was different in one way. As you could say, Dylan's art was in music from he kind of stands out even among musicians, being very unique, and his style is so unique. But then Gregory Peck is Atticus, so I could see why these two men had that bond. And when it happened at the Kennedy Center, it was kind of like all those threads pulling together to me. So it was a very moving. At that point in time, these men stood up.
I totally agree with you, and I love that you – thanks for telling me that story, Bob. What is it specifically, if you don't mind my asking – that draws you to Bob Dylan so much?
When I first heard him, I went and bought a record, and it ended up being somebody else singing his song. And then when I bought his record, it was the Birds, like, singing Mr. Tambourine Man when I was younger. And, and I went out and got one of his actual records. And then I put it on, and the voice was so different. And in a sense, when you first hear it, it's not pleasant in and of itself when you first hear it. But I had never heard anyone else say words like he had said, the way he said them and the things he was talking about, you know, and the phrasing he came up with was so unique. Even the Beatles bowed to his lyrics, you know, saying what a talented lyricist he was. But no one else had been saying these things. And people can use politics for, you know, power, like you could stand for a cause because it's, you know, you can promote something and you can be promoted while you promote it. So the people, I guess, intuitively, when I was younger, I wanted to really listen to were people you felt were telling you the truth. So when you saw a movie like To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, at times it might be fashionable to stand up for that, but the people who really felt it and really cared about equality, and if you're a star, you know, the level your dad was at or Bob Dylan is at, and you're kind of taking a chance by saying those things, like, you know, someone's bringing a rifle into the place, like, you know, that's a serious business. And yet they still took a time out where they didn't, you know, Greg could have made another Guns of Navarone or such. I think that actually came out after, but To Kill a Mockingbird, but you know what I mean. But he still stood and put this movie out, and it wasn't popular with everybody in those days. And, you know, there, a lot of people were getting shot at that time. So, you know, you look at the Kennedys as well, John and Bobby Kennedy, I think, were the last two political hopes we've had in a very long time. And, you know, the people who stood up for that same message, and they say, well, these were only men, you know, they had these faults. But that doesn't matter. You know, like I think Bob Dylan said, it doesn't matter that all these people went out with bullets, because the good that they planted, the seeds that they planted remain. So, you know, somebody like your dad has left all these movies. They touched a kid, you know, the kid I was going to see these movies, and I saved all these books, you know, that the movies were based on. So I know that they were calling out to me because I didn't do that with everybody. And I think they helped form my belief system and the way I thought of people, you know, by seeing those movies and listening to those songs. Like Bob Dylan's It's All Right, I'm Really Bleeding. Like, who has a song with that title, you know? The Bay City Rollers didn't put that out. But, you know, when I see those movies, something about it is truthful and it sticks to you. And, you know, you're not hungry a half an hour after you eat the meal. It sticks with you. And I think in American culture, that movie is etched into it. So what more can you want from someone who's popular and an entertainer when they can also touch your conscience and touch your soul and make you remember what they did in a way where you're also being entertained? So it goes out to the general public. It doesn't just go out to elites who, you know, there's nothing wrong with being educated, but for the people who haven't had that opportunity to have that put, you know, in their path in a movie theater, I think that's a very powerful thing. And those people in the 60s at that point in time, the Kennedys, Bob Dylan, Gregory Peck, the people who stood up, you know, that sticks with you. And we could use more of that today.
Well, I totally agree with you. And like you, I love Bob Dylan. I feel about him the same way you do. I just absolutely love what he does, and for the same reasons. You put it so simply. Something about it is true.
And what's funny is you guys, Bob, you got on him in the same way I did in this respect. I heard a cover of I Shall Be Released, and you love that song. It's a beautiful song. And I heard it long before I heard Bob Dylan do it. And then I heard him do it, and I said, oh, that's what this is all about. That's what Bob Dylan is all about. Suddenly the song was like a real journey. It was a real dilemma. It was a real tragedy. And I you can't put it any other way. And it's funny, doesn't Tony's Sinatra has a son who's huge on Dylan, doesn't he? Was it Bobby?
Yes. His stepson, Bobby Marks, loves Bob Dylan almost to the exclusion of all other music. And I understand that too. I've gone through phases where I, you know, if it wasn't by Frank, I didn't need to hear it. If it wasn't by Dylan, I'm not interested. It's not the Rolling Stones. So people develop these obsessions, but you're right. Bobby Marks had that for Dylan, but I love the way you expressed yourself about why he's meaningful to you, Bob.
Well, and they stick with you, you know. If Gregory Peck movie is on, or if I have the DVD, it doesn't matter how many times I've seen it. You can always catch something in it that you didn't catch the first time you wrote it. And last time, you know, we were able to discuss so many of his movies and mention them. And then I was looking at how many we didn't even mention tonight, just like The Yearling. We didn't even talk about Spellbound. We didn't talk about Designing Women. We didn't even talk about Porkchop Hill, which was a real interesting movie with a different viewpoint on war. Captain Newman, MD, about PTSD, MacArthur, just all these movies, How the West Was Won. We didn't even get to mention those last time. And, you know, any actor would probably be glad to have one or two of these. and your dad was just putting them out one after the other. And as Bob Dylan, if you look at his records, there's really no throwaway songs. So in that way, and in what they stood for, they, you know, I think it's just such a cut above what everyone else did. And it can sound silly to say something is timeless, but if something is really true, somehow it mystically becomes timeless. And their the messages that they were speaking about through their art, I think, resonate because they're really true. You know, decency, the way you comport yourself, to have a style about the way you do it. But the style is just an inroad, maybe to get someone's attention. But it's really the message that, you know, they're speaking. Usually that's behind all that and hidden in there somewhere. It's not, you know, smacking you in the face. And the way that they set it up, I just think those things are something from that period that will always last. And if someone caught onto it in 200 years or something, I think there would still be something there to see. So what more can you ask for?
Bob, you need to be more vocal on your show than you are. I mean, that's brilliant. It's brilliant what you just said. And it's succinct, and it's certainly how I see it. I mean,
well, you guys had such chemistry that, you know, just anyone, you know, even a fool is counted wise when he's silent. So I did okay, because you guys had such chemistry, and you're friends, and it just came out that I was smart enough to know not to touch that. But being able to speak to you at the end is something, you know, I'll always remember that would, you know, be with me as long as I'm here on this earth, because those movies meant so much to me and the ripples that go out from them. So when I get to speak to people like you guys, it reminds me of that and it strengthens it in me. So, you know, the power of that art still comes through, you know, you guys and what you're doing and your friendship. And, you know, you had an up close view of it and you share it. You know, I'm smarter to use my ears than my mouth in a show like that. So I thank you for being here.
Well, I'm going to say always, but it's only the second time we've really done this with you, Bob, but it is such a pleasure and so much fun. And I hope we do it again, you know, and if not for a show, just the three of us. It's fun.
Well, I couldn't, nothing would make me happier. And I just mentioned the book again, Marlon and Greg, My Life and Filmmaking Adventures with Hollywood's Polar Opposites. It came out in 2021 by Bear Manor Media, or you can find it on Amazon.com. And I thank you, gentlemen, for sharing your conversation with us. I do hope you'll be back again, and the door's wide open anytime you want to come on. So I wish you both good night.